So cut to, I'm going to do Hollywood Shuffle. And so I go to Paul, you know, and I'm like asking people to be in the movie. A lot of people said no to me. And so I say, hey, Paul, Mr. Mooney, I'm going to do a movie. Would you be in the movie? And he goes, have you ever directed a movie before? And I go, no. Have you ever written a movie before? I go, no. He says, either you're the dumbest nigga I've ever met or you're a genius. I'm in. And he agreed to do the movie. Either you're the dumbest nigga I've ever met or you're a genius.
Started McGee with a little silver screen second where we're going to take a brief second to quiz one another on some Tinseltown trivia and test our Hollywood insight. I got a multiple choice question. You ready, brother?
Always.
So you had some old bullshit to say about the town in our last shooting ship episode. I didn't really appreciate some old hating shit that I've come to expect from you about how SoCal and the shooting community, how the community responds to you shooting a film out here. All right.
So I'm coming
I'm coming to California's defense here because motherfuckers love to come build their little careers here in the town and then turn around and talk shit, as McGee just aptly shown us. All right. That's so, you know, a transplant for real. So I want to celebrate LA coming together as a community and helping to build this project. We're going to start here. The famous Winky Dinky Dog sequence was a literal scene-stealing location, or might as well have been. For the deal that Townsend scored, shooting inside was a little too expensive, so Robert worked out a deal to shoot the parking lot for A, $700. Was it B, $1,000? Was it C, $150? Or was it D, $50? How much love did the community of LA show Robert Townsend real early in his dream of creating his first film?
See, just the way you're pitching it makes me want to go with 50. I was already going to go 150, but the excess, I don't know, though. The 50 might be there just to catch me. I'll still say 50. I don't think it would, 700 wouldn't be remarkable. So it's definitely either C or D. But I'm going to go with the lowest, 50.
D.
Just to buy a nice solid bottle of booze and we're square.
D, $50. Ding, ding. Maybe I did put a little too much on it.
I know you too well.
Didn't put enough on this film because I think it's incredible. We're going to talk about 1987's Hollywood Shuffle coming up after this. And is he going to disappoint me? I don't know. Let's find out. Coming up after this.
The suspense.
Welcome to Make Me Watch. We're a couple of failed filmmakers who are forever students of cinema on an eternal quest to watch more movies. I'm your host, E, and I'm joined by my co-host, Shawnee. He ain't begotten no weapon. Sean McGee, how are you, brother?
You don't mess with the wrong dude, baby. I'm doing good. How you doing?
Oh, I can't complain, dude. All right. This is a show where Sean and I trade off forcing one another to watch our favorite films. But before we get into all that, we want to thank you for listening wherever you happen to be listening from. You could be doing anything else with your time or happy you're here with us. Follow our socials in the show notes while scrolling down there. Please rate, review, give us 5 stars, and support us. Support your local artists. And join us on Patreon for exclusive shows. We have some entertaining exclusives over there. McGee, what do you think people should be pairing with this film this week?
That's a good question. I think if you're a new listener, you should definitely be dropping us a review. Don't forget to do that. And maybe go back and listen to Babylon. As much as I hated that movie, I think it's a fun episode where we are having a spirited discussion of a movie that we are on different sides of. Will that be the case today? Stay tuned to find out.
And on today's episode, we have my pick for the week in 1987's Hollywood Shuffle. We're going to give our overall thoughts up top without spoiling and then dive into this film with our world-famous segments that break down the plot, performance, and our favorite behind-the-scenes story. So without further ado, let's get into our review of 87's Hollywood Shuffle.
Hi, my name is Robert Townsend, and it's hard to make a movie in Hollywood, but I did, with the help of a few friends and a few credit cards.
What's the line?
I ain't be got no weapon.
My film's about making it as an actor in Hollywood.
The only role they gonna let us do is a slave, a butler, or some street hood or something. Don't sell out, brother.
Oh, the promised land. Minnesota?
But the real trick is finding a juicy role when the odds are against you.
Good luck, brother.
What we're looking for is an Eddie Murphy type.
What is happening with your cool vines?
Thank you.
You're the worst actor I've ever seen in my life.
Then they said I wasn't black enough for the part.
Ricky, can you tell us what you've been doing since you've graduated?
Well, Robert, I've played 9 crooks, 4 gang leaders, 2 dope dealers. I played a rapist twice.
Whoa.
That was fun.
They'll never play the Rambos until they stop playing the Sambos.
Yeah! I just want to be me. I don't want to be Eddie Murphy.
He's the one we want.
Hollywood Shuffle.
Now that was a good movie.
I love this movie. It was genius.
Go see it today, please, because I got to pay off these credit cards. Tell your friends about it. Lots of friends, your cousins, your aunts, your uncles, maybe your ex-wife.
All right, that was from the trailer of 1987's Hollywood Shuffle. The logline is an actor imagines in vignettes how Hollywood stereotypes his race. This is directed by and starring Robert Townsend. Shot by Peter Deming. I didn't actually check that before we started.
As a matter of fact, crazy. Go back and check out our My Cousin Vinny episode for some more Peter Deming content.
We've had some Deming love on the pod already. Mm-hmm. This is written by Robert Townsend and Keenan Ivory Wayans. What a middle name there. I didn't know that one either. This is starring Robert Townsend as Bobby Taylor, Keenan Ivory Wayans as Donald and Jerry Curl, Damon Wayans as bodyguard number 2 and Willie. We got Annie Marie Johnson as Willie May, Hooker number 5 and Lydia, and the legend Helen Martin as Bobby's grandmother. So, yeah. As always, we start out with the titular question here. Eric, why'd you make us watch this?
Well, I think this film is really special for a number of reasons. Chief among them, this film is one of the nexus points of the second golden era of black television, and it changes the course of the Super Bowl eventually. This film does stand on its own merit, so I'm not going to bury the lead, but I just want to acknowledge up top that this film has a special place in black cultural lore, so I'll land the plane on that here at the end. But Townsend, to start at the start, was an extra for like 7 years. Do you go with extra or do you go with background artists? I'm actually curious in your own personal vocabulary. Are you more of an extras kind of guy?
Oh, I just say extra.
Are you a background? You're not a background artist kind of guy? It's
a little bit debate. I never switched it over because it was never honestly relevant to me. So that's, not great for me, but it's the truth.
This film is largely built around those experiences. He meets Keenan Ivory Wayans during that time. And they're on that like stand-up audition circuit. And this, they form this film as a response to, frankly, like the humiliating and sort of disregard for black stories and their humanity that they were experiencing by and large through Hollywood gatekeepers, but also from inside the ranks. There's a really funny scene regarding that in the opening audition sequence where people were sniping each other even during the really trying time. But the response leads to this brilliant, I feel like inspired collage on acting, on performing, on the aspirations and humanity and humor of black folks. Townsend means a lot to the community because I think his like general overall good naturedness, he's kind of like the black Jimmy Stewart a little bit. He's like really lovable, but he doesn't necessarily change from performance to performance. And it's evident, I think, in the community coming out to support this project. For instance, shooting in the Baldwin Hills Theater for Real Brothers. There's the Real Brothers sequence. They did that for next to nothing just because those two brothers that own the theater in the black affluent part of town. Anybody knows anything about Baldwin Hills in L.A., the black affluent part of town, really just saw the vision behind him and wanted to get behind what he was doing. This is, like I mentioned, his director, if I didn't mention this, his directorial debut. Townsend had been working a little while, like he's coming off a Soldier Story before this with Denzel. And he's kind of looking to keep the ball rolling and be involved in these productions that have these AAA productions that have this kind of premium on, you know, a director's actor, you know what I mean? And like getting the actors involved in some of the choices that they're making. Another person that, you know, he gets involved with this film, like, you know, I just mentioned a Soldier Story, Norman Jewison, who directs that. He meets Patrick Soure on this, who ends up producing that. And he gives him all the short ends of a Soldier Story. And if you don't know what short ends are, like a standard theatrical 35mm reel, which is like, let's say like 10 minutes and some change, 11 minutes. Like if you shoot 7 minutes of it, you know, there's 3 minutes on there that you can possibly sell or throw away, or it may end up in storage. Or in this case, you know, people coming together, LA coming together as a community and giving, you know, the short ends of a Soldier Story to Robert Townsend to shoot his vision. Here's an ambitious filmmaker, more of the town coming together, putting their arms around young talent. And maybe my favorite anecdote on this is all time is Samuel Goldwyn, ends up buying the film. And, as they're screening the film, he's like, him and Townsend in the little theater, the back lot, whatever, screening the film. He's loving it. He's like, I'm not exactly sure what a Jerry curl is, but don't change a frame of this. This is hilarious. I love this. But he goes, Townsend's like, maybe it was like on a Friday. Don't quote me on the days, but he's like, hey, can I get the check for the film? Coming up this weekend. And he's like, well, you know, our offices are open this weekend. And I was like, that's fine. My apartment is. So he's like, why do you need the money so quick? It's like, well, I put the second half of the film on credit cards. And, you know, and I told the actors after we sold the film, because everybody did it on pro bono. Everybody did it for, you know, out the love that I would just pay them, you know, when we sold the film. And so he's, he loved the idea of him putting it all on credit cards, the financial logistics of it all. And he loved, so he sent an accountant out, you know, to Robert's apartment on a Sunday, and 82 actors showed up and got paid. You know, like that's the kind of fucking shit you do as a filmmaker, as a director. You're like, yeah. I'm gonna take care of you guys. Like, just, you know, fucking, like, just trust me. If we do get it right, I'm gonna take care of you guys. So I love that, because I think that really is like Townsend's, you know, the ethos of the man and what he means to the community. Because a lot of Townsend films I grew up with, like, you don't know Meteor Man yet. You do kind of, because you saw Kendrick. Oh, do you really know Meteor Man? I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Okay, shit. But I grew up on Meteor Man. I grew up on...
That was one of the ones where I was like, why do I have this picture of him in my head as a superhero? And I looked it up and I'm like, oh yeah, I've seen this fucking movie.
I love that. I truly do. you see the influence of Townsend's films and what, you know, this being a genesis of like a lot of the premier talent. Keenan goes on to write and direct, you know, I'm gonna get you sucker after this, which is classic. I'm definitely gonna put that on at some point. But, you know, in the wake of this, In Living Color follows, and Living Color goes to steal 22 million people from the NFL during a halftime show. And then the NFL, you know, subsequently hires Michael Jackson to steal them back that following year. But this is all because of like Keenan, like two friends for a brief moment in time, like the creative boom from these two helped to shepherd in, you know, Friday and in Living Color and Fear of a Black Cat and CB4 and the Wayans brothers and the scary movie genre, the scary movie satire genre, Parenthood, Meteor Man, you know, it was a revelation. It starts here in 87 because they were like, we hate the fucking stereotypes, we want to go shoot this. I love the blend, the collage, the life story, the biopic, like all of it coming out in this really kind of, it's, I will get into a bit of my criticisms. I do think Townsend, for my taste, is a little saccharine in areas. Like, I'm definitely more of a Keenan Ivory Wayans kind of like cynic kind of guy in my humor.
Yeah.
So we'll get to that in a little bit. But the love that Townsend showed for the community and put his passions into this is really why I think this is a valuable film. So very curious to get your opinion up top. This is your first time watching it. I definitely have my critiques as well. So I don't want to like completely like, you know, if you want to do your thing. I'm very, very curious.
Yeah, for sure. There will be critiques that I get into, but largely I was absolutely in love with this movie for sure. Like, to the point where I know when I guessed the plot of the movie in last week's episode, and you were kind of like, oh, like I that would be the version that we would write. I'm like, no, absolutely, you're wrong. Like, this is way better as it is. Like, don't touch a frame is absolutely the correct response when seeing this for sure. Where I'm like, I don't want to see the more traditional version that I had in my head with the, like, you know, one giant arc of, like, I really love the, like, this is way more cohesive than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be way more isolated vignettes, but, and not the, like, kind of cutaway gags that are, and, like, dream sequences and stuff. It still remained cohesive as a story and as a movie, even with devoting significant chunks of it to parody, where we're having the same actors cycle through roles. Yeah. Like, that's what made it feel so tight-knit and so, like, the joy of the filmmaking part of the process that I love, you know, getting that feeling on screen. Like, reusing props, reusing costumes, reusing actors, like, really making every little piece work, where it's just like, no, this is the exact scale. The story is the exact scale that fits the movie that they could make and should have made. Like, that is, it's definitely something I'm like, you know, hands off for sure. I have a few criticisms that I'll get into later after the spoiler jump as well. And there's one little, like, scene addition that I would like to tack on.
Interesting.
But for the most part, like, I really, really enjoyed not only, like, have it, you know, just watching this, there's parts where it's uncomfortable for sure. There's parts where I'm like, well, I don't have anything to say about this. Like, you lived that experience, so, like, if that's what you wanted to say about it, sure. That's, I feel a little bit weird about it, but, like, that's my shit to work out, I guess. But there are other actual criticisms that I have that I'll get into. But largely, I was really, just structurally, it was so fun and unique that I just really had a good time watching it.
Did you, I'm very curious, like, so you're kind of working out, you know, what I put on it in terms of, like, you know, the more traditional aspect of it. How much of that are you battling as you're watching it and seeing how it's starting, it's slower? I feel like it kind of start, I guess, well, you know what, maybe that's a better conversation for Big Bang. So let me not ask that now. Let's just ask, how did you watch it? Did you end up...
I watched it free on Tubi.
Tubi on free. I think there's Sling for free, and there's Amazon Prime if you want to do a commercial free. Or Criterion. I want to talk about the Criterion edition of the DVD. Fantastic. A lot of supplemental materials. Yeah. And a lot of those background actors that we were talking about are, like, recycling from scene to scene, have a spot in here to kind of talk about their experiences shooting the film. And like Sean mentioned, and we'll mention a little later, the communal aspect of this, people bringing their own wardrobe and doing their own hair and makeup and everybody just kind of getting involved. Was
one of the things Natalie noticed was the, like, costumes would be hanging in the background as set dressing.
Oh, really?
That would get used in different scenes.
That's interesting.
Like, it'd be like them hanging on racks or whatever, like, in the background, and then later that dress would pop up, like, on somebody in an actual scene. It was, like, unrelated to that where it was before.
That's funny.
Just that, like, efficiency of it all is really just making it work.
I love that. Yeah, so I would suggest it. Great essay, great supplemental materials, a conversation with Elvis Mitchell and Robert Townsend talking about this. Really, really great addition to your DVD shelf. And speaking of which, who may also have this on theirs?
I mean, you mentioned, like, obviously the legacy that this has with, you know, obviously In Living Color. Like, I think down the line, like, you can see the Chappelle Show, like, influence of it as well, but, like, but obviously I think the really hard turns into genre, like, is like, oh, like, this is Key. You could see where Key and Peele would have looked back into this stuff, and imagining a world where Robert Townsend kind of got the keys to the castle as much as Jordan Peele has now,
because he does a television one season sort of variety take on it, like,
yeah,
he doesn't get it. But you know what's crazy about the Chappelle Show bit? Rusty Cundiff, who is a major, I mean, he was the main director for the Chappelle Show. He's in the cast. He's in a lot of the film. He's one of the zombie pimps, but he's the dude in the casting line. Like when they go across and he's like, Hollywood doesn't think I'm black, or they don't give light skinned brothers like a chance to be hoods or whatever like that.
Oh, and like he's that, like, I put Rusty on suntan lotion.
Yeah, yeah. So I can't remember what his name is. The taller, or the one, slender one, the taller, slender one, Rusty could do. But yeah, you picked up well. Yeah, because that's absolutely, and that's another. It's like Rusty comes out of this, and the Chappelle Show comes out of this, and who I picked out of this is, you know. So we're gonna talk. I don't nearly care about the Eddie shots as much as I let on in this podcast, but so it's gonna be interesting to talk about the Eddie scene in this one. But Eddie actually sees this scene with Robert Townsend and Keanu Ivory Wayans. We'll get into it after the break because they had a big fight between the two of them as creatives. But Eddie loved it so much that he ends up hiring Robert Townsend, and that's how he shoots Raw. So
I thought it was the other way around. I didn't realize that it was that way. Even funnier.
Yeah. So after Eddie calls him and says, you know, hey, everybody's telling me to go see Hollywood Shuffle. Can you set up a screening? I'll leave a little bit of the story coming from after that. But based on the events of that, is how he leads into the job for Raw. But also, the Chicago Jones sequence. Got a lot of love from Steven. So Steven Spielberg calls Townsend out. He's like, I was a huge fan, blah, blah. Can you come out to the house? I want you to read for a part. I don't have a multiple choice or anything set up for it, but you won't even imagine. You couldn't even imagine the part. But it was when Steven had the script for Benjamin Button, and I guess he wanted him to read a role for The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. Yeah. But he ended up not doing the project, and Fincher ends up taking it, obviously. But yeah, he came out to Steven's house to read a part for Benjamin Button based on the Chicago Jones.
That's so funny. You know, the role that I was going to pitch for him was, if I had to guess what role he was reading for around this time, I was going to say Jurassic Park.
Oh,
if he was doing like Goldblum's role.
Oh, he's in the back of the truck with his shirt off like that.
he's doing it in this one. He's got the body for it.
That's hilarious. You know what? That's the other thing. Like, he at this age particularly.
I didn't even think him for Sam Jackson's role. I was 100% just thinking Goldblum.
He has such an angular, elongated, almost like cartoonishly proportioned body for me. That's why, similar to why I illustrated him in our little show bills, like a two-head long neck. It's like his body is so, it's like to shoot such an interesting gestural kind of like a body to shoot. I love a lot of the, the old boy in the zombie,
With his arm.
Oh my god, I could do that. Like that kind of shot there. Just like that's what so a lot of that
it's
makes
so
it.
Funny. Yeah. I love this in this
film. Really quick before we go out, scene we get to show someone or get somebody to watch. This is built around vignettes, built around scenes. Which one could you get someone to watch with?
I think there were a lot of potential candidates because this is so vignette-y. It's like you really could pick so many different things, and they would all work. What I ultimately went with, though, was the dreaming of success sequence towards the end of the movie, where he's like kind of mulling over the pep talk and getting chewed out on set, and then it goes through like the different like Rambo. What was the subtitle for Rambo?
For Youngblood? Or was it
First Youngblood? Yeah, That's what it was. First Youngblood. Fuck. It's so good. That's a good bit. Oh shit. And then I can't remember the other one that they do, but then it goes to him like getting the Oscar and everything, and he's like, oh, my fifth. Yeah. Like it's just a good like goofy.
He threw was it Helen Mirren? No, he threw
Helen Mirren. Yeah, he was in the category against Pacino, De Niro, and Helen Mirren. It's just like this movie's inability to take anything seriously for any like length of time is perfect. And that's why I thought this was a good scene for it, but also kind of wraps up the themes.
I went with the classic for me has always been Real Brothers. And this is this is where Townsend, I can't remember old boy's name, but they sneak into the theater and they do essentially a Robert and Ebert style show with a thumbs up, thumbs down. But it's from a black perspective on these. So they do Amadeus. But it's hilarious that they don't recommend it because they couldn't pronounce it to the girl. And they're going to take him out on a Saturday night. And Attack of the Pimps comes out of this. I love this sequence a lot. Again, this is one that shot in the Baldwin Hills for next to nothing. Beautiful. They captured that. As a matter of fact, Robert Ebert goes on to be a huge proponent of this film based on that scene. Just in the style that they do it. The last one I went, obviously, I'm a noir fan. The Sam May stuff, although there's some fortunate slur that's in here. I do love the I love his take on a noir. I'm gonna get into, you know, the Jerry Curl activator scene, which is to this day gold. Like I love every moment of this. And I'll talk about it in several ways a little later on. But yeah, so I went Real Brothers, Sam May sequence, two of my favorites. And we're gonna talk about some more of it. The opening of this film coming up after this.
Our first film is Gone with the Wind. This film is an epic romance centering around Scarlett O'Hara, a damsel in distress during the Civil War. It is a must-own, must-see movie. I highly recommend it.
I couldn't agree with you more. I've actually seen Gone with the Wind 13 times since I was 10 years old. No kidding.
You must be on crack. I don't think we've seen the same movie. I thought Scarlett was a hoe because she went to bed with everybody but Mammy. I love Mammy. And Mammy was the best scene in the movie is when Mammy told the white people, "Get off my porch, white trash." I stood and I applauded. I loved every bit of it.
I liked Mammy, though. I thought she was great. I thought she had a great role.
Do you know, in real life, it was Hattie McDaniels. They wouldn't let Mammy go to the opening. Hollywood goes too far. But she's dead.
Adorable.
But she's dead. But everybody comes back. Everybody comes back to get their money. She came back as Oprah Winfrey to get her money.
Welcome to our focus group. We'll be breaking down the plot. From here on out, we will be spoiling the film. Starting with the start, as always, in the Big Bang. Did that opening sizzle or fizzle? What do you think?
I ain't be gotten no weapons. I think I love the start, but I think the movie really begins in earnest with the casting audition sequence. Some of it, you know, we're running through the credits and he's getting ready in the mornings. I do like the play on, you know, is this going to be a particular, you know, blend of black exploitation sort of trick at the beginning. So we're just hearing the voice of like the Tommy as he's running lines.
And then ridiculous.
Yeah, and we cut into the bathroom. You're sort of piecing it together and you see he's running lines with his brother. You know, he's getting ready in the morning, kissing his grandma, you know, seeing, you know, the friends outside running, you know, he's driving a little bit, meeting his girl, or at least you know, saying bye to his girl, wishing him luck for the audition. And then, I think the movie, how the motif of the film, the really heart of the film is going to start in this audition sequence. This is a standout for the film for me. First and foremost, I love like the two big cinematography motifs in this sequence. One being like the slow glide down the audition line, and we're seeing these performers in small vignettes. It's a motif I really enjoy. The next is the really static shot of the three-headed casting director. I love the Venetian blind sort of shot in this. I love the revolving door of the auditions in this one static shot.
Yeah.
I think that the casting directors themselves, I love all the bits of them, like not paying attention or giving contradictory goals to the actors. Just like, be relaxed, but be firm. We're going to do this.
Yeah. Like nothing amounting to anything. Right. Like just completely substanceless notes. Like,
absolutely.
Perfect.
Smiling too big. This all played really well. And I think, because I've shot a number of, I used to work with a casting director. I've shot a number of casting auditions. I know you have too in your past. There's something about sitting in the room for like 4 to 6 hours and you're really having to have to like, at least fluctuate, you know, and build enthusiasm from everybody. So it doesn't just feel like a long droll coming in. Hopefully there's somebody there that does really kind of like spark and everyone gets excited about, but it can feel like, I think something about this static shot and seeing this revolving door of actors sort of creates that monotonous sort of feeling a little bit, that if you've done this, you sort of get that feeling of like, you know, another person, another person, another person, another person.
You start
So it's a really fun opening for me. How about yourself?
I like the opening for sure. I think it's funny you called out my like softest criticism of SoCal with them being the most annoying place to film something because they don't give a shit about you. or what you're trying to do, for the most part. The opening where everybody's like, oh, good luck on your audition, and like everybody's cheering him on. I'm sitting there going like, what the fuck is this cheery ass Disney ass bullshit? And so when he finally pulled up to work and they were just like, hey, look, it's fucking, I can't Marlon remember Brando. Hey, Marlon Brando's here. I was like, there we go. There's the Southern California I know.
Because Keaton is sorting through something, like he's either sorting through napkins or something like that. He goes, I can't remember, Donald. He's like, what's up, Donald? And he's like, work. Just how he says it.
I was like, okay, there we go. Now I feel better represented. This makes more sense.
Early look at John Witherspoon, too. There's another comedian that they were, you know, running with during the stand-up circuit. So we're going to talk we'll take another the most popular John Witherspoon role next month. We'll get into that in a couple weeks. But here he is as a Winky Dinky Dog's boss. Let me talk to you about something I had caught in this viewing that I had noticed before. It's the story I kind of talked about up top with Eddie and Damon and Townsend. So they were all, again, you know, they're in the stand-up circuit and they all knew each other and they knew Eddie and Keenan and Robert, who are both writing this film. Robert Townsend, again, the writer-director. Keenan, who's playing Donald, and Jerry Curl, the scene a little later on. They get in a huge fight about this, where Keenan doesn't want to do this. He doesn't want to make fun of Eddie. He's like, you know, we know him, blah, blah, blah. But Robert's like, you know, if we're talking about the Black acting experience in Hollywood at this time, we're running into a lot of these casting directors that are asking for this. And I love this fucking sequence in this movie where it's like this dark, surreal, nightmarish take on casting directors acting all these actors to play different versions of Eddie Murphy, and they're all doing this Eddie Murphy impression. He's almost like he's turning into like an Eddie Murphy werewolf kind of, where he's like changing into Eddie Murphy. Yeah. Gets his will.
He's like can't help himself. The laugh comes out. So good. It was almost the scene I picked for the scene he'd show, because it's just like such a good punchy bit.
Absolutely.
What we're looking for is an Eddie Murphy type.
We want somebody who can act like Eddie Murphy from head to toe. That's what we want.
Someone who can dress like Eddie Murphy, to look like Eddie Murphy, to be Eddie Murphy, to give him the actor himself a Murphy-ectomy, to have a Murphy-like quality, Murphy-esque, to be Murphonic. Okay.
Shut up.
Hey, hello, kids. It's your friend, Mr. Roberts.
Me.
There he is. He's the one we want!
I just want to be me. I don't want to be Eddie Murphy. I just want to be me.
Yes!
Get the fuck out of here! That's what we're looking for.
Eddie, again, like I mentioned, hears about this. He sets up a screening for him. Everyone's laughing, and then it gets to the scene. And Eddie has an entourage of maybe like, you know, 10, 11 guys there, and everybody gets real, real quiet at this scene in the middle of the theater. And Keenan, you know, has his head down. Robert Townsend just like, you know, he's kind of like, but then Eddie kind of goes with it. He starts laughing and he's like, oh, why y'all do me like that? Like, he starts laughing, kind of going with everybody, kind of relaxes.
Yeah.
At the end of the screening, people kind of clear out and Eddie's in there, you know, by himself. And Robert goes up to him and says, you know, I just want to apologize if you took any offense to that. You know, you take shots at other comedians. So we were just having a little fun. He's like, no, I loved it. And he's like, you know, I'm doing my special. And that like, I want to know if you want to shoot this, because whatever. And that's how Robert Townsend ends up getting the job for Ross. So. So that I caught this viewing, because I would have never known that beyond this commentary in the Criterion edition of the DVD, that Keenan I guess what really surprised me, because Keenan is like the cynic of the two of them. You know what I mean? Like, he is the real more biting one. He's the more like surrealist one. So I'm like, that would have felt to me like a Keenan scene, a Keenan sort of like take on that, like a Wayans Brothers sort of like scary movie satire, we're gonna go a step further, whatever kind of like the scene. But to hear that back in the day that he was a little scared to take shots at Eddie, I was like, oh really? That's kind of funny. Compliment sandwich, McGee. Can I make you a sandwich real quick about my compliments and complaints on this?
Yeah, yeah. I got a little sandwich of my own as well. But
you want to start us off? Ahead.
No. Start us off. Yeah, start us off.
So the bread being, it's actually going to be the barbershop scene where I think this is where I run into my problems with Townsend a bit. It's because it's the schmaltzy scene, and I get this is Robert at his most earnest, but I also think it's at his weakest. It's a nakedly cringy, believe in yourself kind of bullshit, like laughably overly saccharine kind of like music in the background scene. But the other side of the bread is I do think those are sometimes needed, and I'm going through a little phase of my life where as an artist, you're just like, sometimes you hear those messages, you're like, as nakedly saccharine as they are, you kind of need your sandwich in there. You need it on the sandwich.
Yeah,
you need
it when
on the
plate hits, a little it hits.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I do think in his films, there is that sort of, well, if we all just band together and do right kind of thing where I'm just like, yeah, all right. I've seen a number of those band togethers get, you know, crushed and by the powers that be. And I also like to hear the flip side of that story. Sometimes happiness is a little too little too sweet for me sometimes. But yeah, that was mine. What about yours? It's your sandwich.
So for my compliment sandwich is there's not minority groups like women and queer groups are not represented in this movie. They're obviously, it's not the focus. It's not the movie about everybody. It's a movie about like the Black experience that they're writing, what you know. But I did appreciate the little bits of inclusion that of like women going through the same bullshit. The queer representation is handled a little less admirably, but it does. I think because there's characters in there where they're in there for a quick joke, like even the opening joke when he like knocks on the window and he's like, me? And he's just like, no, obviously not. Get her. It's funny. Like it doesn't feel homophobic. It feels like it comes from a place of community and understanding and just knowing being around other people and stuff. So there, like you said, there's, you know, some moments, some words used where it's like, that's not great, but ultimately, it does feel like the movie comes from a place of love in that. Like, and so I think the sincere, like, schmaltzy moments, as he said, like, you do kind of need some of those to kind of get you through the other moments. Like, honestly, for me, the Real Brothers sequence had some of the funniest shit and also some of the shit where I was like, ugh.
Oh, really? Which part?
I don't know.
Which part made you like, ugh?
It just like the voice and the face he was doing felt not far off from the role that he's being asked to do at the end of the movie, where I'm like, I feel weird about this. Like, right. I think there's just also moments of it that are so fucking funny, but the sequence is so long. There's moments of it that just aren't either.
Right.
And so it was a little bit hit or miss for me. Also, just the Real Brothers pun was so good, and then they don't, like, they just kind of throw it away and never go back to it, and then they name the show something else, the show within the show. Yeah. I was like, no, I want to see a Real Brothers like logo, like this, like
that in the Black Acting School. I wish there was a logo for. I tried to draw one a little bit in the
Black Acting School was so funny.
I love this scene, and which is a sequence is why I wrote, you know, the BAFTA's been fucking up, because Robert was having this experience. One of the last experiences he had that, you know, influences the movie, one is an English director asking him to do, you know, some of this shit on set, or like, stick out your ass and grab your cock, like I know how you brothers do, like that kind of shit. He had another one where a production designer was going in and like, in the apartment sequence, and I think like taking cereal and tossing it all around the house and throwing clothes around and spilling milk on the table or something like that. And he's like, there he walks in on it. He's like, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm trying to create the ghetto, or I'm trying to create a house that looks like in the ghetto. He's like, bro, I live in the hood. Like, we don't have our cereal and milk. How do you think we ate the cereal? He's going on in his head. He ends up talking to the director about this and getting him to kind of like clean it up and whatnot. I can't remember what film it was for, but it was that kind of shit that he was running into that leads into, and it was a bit in his stand-up of like white people trying to coach black people how to act black, and this is where this scene
yeah.
is this. But even how this starts, I love with the with what's his name, Bush something, fuck. Oh boy, the Mandingo dude with it.
Yeah. This is the moment where I say like it's like the way it writes women well too. Yeah. Where like there's never really a scene where like women get to talk about anything other than a dude that's around, which is fine. But the such, I love the like vision of him running away with the white women and the other girl just like holding out her hand like, wait, what? Oh man. And then the realization and then picking herself up is just so fucking brutal and so funny. That's where I'm like, okay, like the shit in there makes me forgive a lot. Like the little moments like that where it's like, you fucking get it, man. This is
like we were talking about Max and the costume for some of his work on like low budget kind of like films. I love that they're in like Levi's and like tied up shirts too for this.
That was one of the things Natalie shouted when we were watching it. She was like, the jeans.
Oh, one of the perfect secrets of black acting school. It was something I didn't understand about this film is why this film isn't a bigger deal. Like you mentioned you hadn't seen this or even heard this film prior to the week before.
Yeah.
Like this feels like it should be on the tip of film school students' tongues in the same way that Clerks or something like that, or El Mariachi or something like that, or She's Gotta Have It, like early they put everything on a credit card type of lore films. I know, because when I grew up with Townsend films, I grew up watching Parenthood, you know, I grew up watching Meteor Man, shit like that, so I didn't necessarily know that story, and I didn't watch Hollywood Shuffle until later in life, like maybe in my teens or something like that. Like it was obviously the superhero one and the other one that came first, or the TV show that came first, but it feels like it should be a bigger deal. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on why it isn't.
I think like obviously like black filmmakers being overlooked and undercredited success is obviously a thing. Yeah. I think TV, and especially like 90s TV, was also like the opposite of like in the 80s you could be a TV star and still be a star. Like 90s TV stars were trying to make movies. Mm-hmm. Like you were trying, TV was the like ugly stepchild of movies in the 90s especially,
right?
And so I think a lot of the like to recognize Hollywood Shuffle success would first like predicate that they need to acknowledge In Living Color. And I think like that's one of those things that is also like undersold and underappreciated like outside of the people in the know,
for sure. No, yeah, I think you're right.
Barbershop is a smart comedy about a day in the life of a black barbershop on the south side of Chicago. It is owned by Ice Cube and inhabited by a colorful cast of characters who bicker with one another in various hilarious ways. Recently, a sequel was made.
You know, it's just a front. It really, they sell drugs out of barbershops.
Welcome back from break. We're going under the lights, breaking down performances. I want to talk about some of the best performances. Like McGee mentioned up top, the rotating cast is I think that's truly where some of the magic comes in, and seeing a lot of people in these different roles. Keenan Wayans, to me, is an absolute breakout comedic performer and possesses that right blend of righteous cynicism and mean-spirited humor for me, but also just like a special, like a unique bit that no one else, like I don't see anyone else coming up with the Jerry Curl bit, like the Jerry Curl torture, like Keenan would, and it's all like, where his hair is kicking up because he doesn't have the activator, he's putting it in and he's being tortured
just instantly, like, too. It's like
it's instantly on every cut, and it's getting worse and worse. Oh
my God, it's a good bit.
I love the sequence. Don Herrera, Eugene Robert Glazer, and Linda Mindy, I believe it is the casting director, like the three-headed casting director bits, like just all in the surreal sequence where she's like doing the, Linda's doing like, or Lisa, excuse me, is doing like the chewing, and it's a really, you know, exaggerated look at her face.
Yeah.
Eugene plays like the Chicago Jones character and like the Dirty Larry character a little later on in the vignette.
Yeah.
Just such a unique, he has the strong man director square jaw kind of take that he uses in three different bits on this one, which is great. Damon Wayans. This is a very early Damon Wayans look. So Damon Wayans is the bodyguard to... This is where early Damon Wayans and his sort of improvish instincts, I think, are... Because he's another genius, comedic genius mind for me. Like, when he's getting out of the car and he's doing it, and they're, like, going around the limo, like, looking for bombs or whatever like that, he, like, goes out the back, it's like, there's a bomb. Oh, no, it was a muffler. Or it's just your muffler. It's incredible. I'm going to talk about a line from his later on that becomes the best line, but, like, early Damon Wayans, Amory Johnson, like McGee mentioned, is, like, the woman that's going to play three different things, like, you know, in this, and stretching her, you know, when she's the girlfriend here, she's playing Willie Mae, one of the girls that gets left behind from the Mandingo, one of the hookers, that, the last hooker to get attacked in the Attack of the Pimps.
Attack of the Street Pimps.
Attack of the Street Pimps. Yeah, she's great in that one. Grant Bush, we mentioned, is the Mandingo, and then he does the Ricky Taylor in the Black Acting School. Rusty
he's, Cundin. That's, yeah. Fucking so funny,
isn't he? And then Rusty Cundiff, we spoke a little earlier. There's just so much talent that came out of this, and they would go on to be in a lot of the, like we mentioned, all the, you know, black cinema films. You know, we're gonna talk Friday, we're gonna talk CB4, we're gonna talk I'm gonna get you sucker, we're gonna talk House Party. It may have actually been lower, but that boom, that creative John Witherspoon, we're gonna talk that creative boom that sort of happened. There's just a lot of talent that came out of this film. So best line reads, McGee. I mentioned Damon Wayans. It's my favorite day. So Damon Wayans in the noir sequence, he's like the little street dude that he's interrogating against the wall. And he goes, and he's like asking him for where like Jerry Curl is. And he goes,
all right. So I didn't see them. But I tell you this though, Mr. Ace, if someone was gonna kill Cookie Head, had been Jerry Curl.
Who's Jerry Curl?
He hated Cookie Head like he was an afro.
Jerry Curl hated Cookie like he was an afro. And in this moment, like, you see, they're both about to break character on that line. They both like turn their heads. To say Jerry Curl hated Cookie like he was an afro. It's just black hair kind of shit. That is just funny black hair humor. And then when he finally finds Jerry Curl, it's like, and then Jerry is like, "You looking for me, punk?" He's like, "You must be Jerry Curl." Like, yeah, how'd you guess?
The sound effect of him just constantly spritzing is that sound just repeating itself over the scene is so fucking good, but just keeps punching.
So the activator gets on everybody too, in like the background, you see them all like wiping their faces. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh no, you're good. I was to say my favorite line is from the NAACP protest scene.
Oh, Paul Mooney! I gotta talk more Paul Mooney. Yeah.
Paul Mooney's line in that is so good. I was like, I don't know if I could say that one, but
you want me to cut it in? Yeah, you go from the Sambos to the Rambos. All right, we go from the Sambos to the Rambos.
Standing outside the home of Bobby Taylor, a young black actor who took a lead role in a stereotypical movie about street life. The NAACP has picketed this movie, but this is the first time that an actor has ever been picketed. Here to explain is the president of the Hollywood branch of the NAACP, Mr. Jamal Harris.
I hope that you're all paid up members of the NAACP Hollywood branch. Thank you. We felt we had to put our foot down by making Bobby Taylor an example. We feel the black actors should not have to accept these stereotype roles, such as crying slaves, tar babies,
jungle bunnies.
I say that as long as black actors play these roles, they'll never play the Rambos until they stop playing the Sambos.
Paul Mooney, we're going to have a clip from Paul Mooney up top. That's the most amazing way he got into this film. But Paul Mooney, legendary comedian and writer for Richard Pryor.
A
big face in the Chappelle Show. Legendary.
There's another line in that sequence that I love where he's his girlfriend like points at the poster or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And they're like, does he make those faces in, or it's a, she's like, all my girls are asking me, does he make those faces in bed? And then the news reporter goes, do you make those faces in bed? And he says, sometimes. Yeah. the punch of the joke, just like 1, 2, 3 is so good. The timing of it is so good. Does he make those faces in bed? Do you make those faces in bed?
Is her saying it, the cut to the poster, then cut to the reaction. It's like that, boom, boom, boom.
It's so snappy. It's so funny. It's my favorite line read for sure. I do also love the other bodyguard just being like, yeah, don't say drugs around him. Don't say coke or freebase either. Unless you got some.
Maddie, Maddie, Maddie. How long do you think your family could have got along with a Detroit bat living in with your suburban family? Like, how long does that last?
I love how absurd the premise is. Like, at the start of the movie, really lets you know what you're getting in for with this fucking bat in the house show, where you're like, wait, what? Is he a vampire? No, he's not a vampire. He's just a bat that's sometimes a guy.
It flies away during... What's amazing too, and I'll get into, maybe this kind of fits all into costume designer, because I just went cast and crew for the best fit costume design, and we want you guys to join us on Patreon. We're going to see a list of the best fits, and I picked several shots down here. Just to kind of highlight the communal process around this, where, you know, Robert Townsend is doing, you know, a lot of the, he's creative, but he's also shepherding people to and fro from set. Handling talent, doing, you know, the whole AD thing. And he's telling people, you know, to bring their clothes, bring their makeup and whatnot. So everyone's kind of contributing in this one. And they're bringing all their, you know, this is their experiences that they've had in their background from Keenan and Robert and you know, injecting this into the film. And that Batty Batty Bat sequence was this time in which he said, where JJ, good times JJ, had came to the hood at one point, and he had like this whole like limo thing and these bodyguards, and you know, they were all trying to go up and talk to him, and he was treating the kids so rude and shit like that. And it just got to be a real dismissive, which is where this Batty Batty Bat sequence kind of comes from. But I love all of that. I love, you know, bringing all the clothing for the Attack of the Pimp sequence, Street Pimp sequence, for the noir sequence, these tutus that they're kind of bringing in for him, and that guy ends up being the martial art dude at the end. He'll carry on for Keenan's "I'm gonna get you, sucker" in another pivotal scene. That's really funny. But to see all of that, people just kind of bringing in and kind of sharing in the vision and bringing what they had to bear to sort of make this realize this vision, I think it was really special. So love all the best fit and the cast and crew that went behind this. And we'll get into, please.
I was going to say,
I meant to toss it to you because you had a great best fit as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, all the fits on this are amazing. And it's especially like knowing that they're all personal closets. The one that I picked from there when they're on the basketball court is just the most like 80s as fuck, like pinnacle. The guys that are actually playing basketball are also wearing completely absurd outfits. But this is like some straight up, like they do some like solid Coca-Cola commercial ass like photography in here. that does LA right for sure. There is one though, you mentioned like those like old school, you know, classic sitcoms, like the, you know, 70s ones and stuff. Wow. That was one of the scenes that I was kind of wanting to add, was I think having Helen Martin there as somebody who's like had all that fucking work done on those old shows, like I would have loved for her to have a scene almost in place of the schmaltzy scene that we got in the barbershop.
Yeah.
I would have loved to give that to her for her to do like, I've gone through this career. Like, I've done what you've done. I've been where you've been.
Yeah.
I figured out my way to make it work. Mm-hmm. And, like, kind of imparting some of that wisdom, I think would have been cool. Especially having her there, giving her a scene like that, I think would have... Not like the movie was missing that, but I think it's an opportunity.
David McKnight does that in lieu of Helen Martin's character, where he, and his background is very similar to hers, where he's been, you know, in all kind of black, they're both black, independent royalty and TV film like legends. But I think adding the Helen bit, the more familial connection, thematically fits a little bit more in what we're doing here. And like, you know, that's her big thing in this film too, is a grandma not like giving her approval so much in what, you know, Townsend's trying to do or trying to get into. So I think that's actually a really apt note in terms of giving that light, you know, into Helen instead of David. Feels
yeah,
like
I mean, you don't even have to cut the other one. You could, I mean, it's not like this movie's too ahead, long. It's a pretty short fucking...
Go ahead, cut one. We don't need two schmaltzy scenes in this.
But you could do, I mean, even the, like, the scene where she falls asleep on the couch and the, you know, and it's like him and his girl, she like spoils the mood for him and his girlfriend or whatever. You could do a kind of like post that scene of like, you know, his girlfriend's asleep on the couch now, and it's like his grandma and him in the kitchen, like talking low and whispered, like real short, you know, version of that. But at least to kind of place that idea, maybe, you know, for then the eventual him deciding not to play the character because it's his grandma's shaking her head disappointingly at him.
Great note. Love it. And we're going to talk about some scenes that we love, or I'm sorry, some shots that we love coming up after this.
The Last Samurai centers around Tom Cruise, a Civil War veteran who goes to Japan and teaches the Emperor's troops how to fight.
Mr. Mooney?
No. Another movie that's... I was offended by it. I mean, Hollywood is crazy. The Last Samurai starring Tom Cruise? Mm-hmm. He's the Last Samurai? Mm-hmm. Give me a break. That movie was offensive. I mean, Hollywood is crazy. First they had The Mexican with Brad Pitt, and now they've got The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise. Well, I've written the film. Maybe they'll produce my film. The Last Nigga on Earth, starring Tom Hanks. How about that?
Welcome back from break. We're going behind the lens, breaking down the film's craftsmanship and its curtain close. You can follow this segment in the show notes, where we post it up on the Patreon. It's a free post. You don't need to sign up for Patreon. It's a free post. But hey, while you're there, go ahead and sign up. We do appreciate it if you do. We're going to talk about DP Peter Deming's work, because he's coming up a few times in this podcast. Cinematographer's legend. A lot of films. Work with Lynch. Work with Myers. Got to start with a lot of different choices here. I think we can owe a lot of his success to his work here with Robert Townsend, because he had so many different... so many different things to capture in these vignettes. I went with the first one, The Attack of the Street Pimps, mostly because I love the pose. I think Peter and Robert captured group silhouettes so well in this film, and this being the start of that, the old boy that can throw his hand behind his head, the old boy in the middle that's just like shaking and like doing his eyes like
just it's so funny because it works so well. Like, it's, they're not doing anything. They're not like, there's no makeup on them at all. They're not like entwining, like, you know, like say,
you don't
sewing
makeup,
their costume
makeup around the eyes. I think there's makeup around the eyes. Like, they, it looks like,
well, okay, yeah, like yeah. a little bit.
But yeah, a lot of it's the expression. A lot of it's the pose that they're selling.
Okay, there's a little, yeah.
And then Anne Marie doing her whole thing where with these hollowed out eyes and like screaming and like not moving fast enough for this group of slow pimp zombies.
It's so funny.
To catch up.
And you're right, though. It's, you would like, obviously, Peter Deming does Evil Dead 2 the same year that he did Hollywood Shuffle.
Yeah.
So he does kind of always live in that like either horror or comedy world. So it's this shot in particular is like him getting to merge the two ideas.
So great.
This is one of my favorite shots too. One of my other favorite shot though is, as we've already talked about it a bit, is the schmaltzy scene with what did we say his name was? David McKnight as Uncle Ray in the barbershop giving him the inspirational talk. It's just one of those scenes where you can, this, so much of this movie is making what they have work, and they're shooting the shit out of it. Mm-hmm. Like the Hollywood acting school where they're doing it all outside. Yeah. Like you can see the limitations of the budget, that they're doing what they can to get like these settings in this gorgeous light. And so they're, you know, chasing light, like natural light when they can use it, and like really leaning into locations instead of doing art direction and stuff. But this one was like, you could tell they were like, okay, but we're gonna do some Hollywood ass cinematic lighting. We're gonna do some light cue. Like, we're going all out on this one. We're giving our boys time to do his monologue. He's gonna have that like soft shadow that makes him all noir-y and dramatic. Like, there was some love put into this scene and the way it was crafted. So I really appreciated the work that was put in there.
I want to talk about the actual locations. I'm glad you brought that up, because he goes a lot into the DVD commentary about what they did to steal. He thinks he may have stolen the most locations of any film ever on this film. And some of his techniques he would talk about is, you know, shooting behind alleys, or shooting on a Sunday morning at like 6 a.m. when the world's kind of asleep still, and getting a lot of his exteriors during that time because he didn't have film permits, and, you know, which is essentially permissions to shoot in areas if you're not in the know, or stealing these kind of, not stealing, but getting these locations for a bargain, like this barbershop, for instance. It was a $200 and you guys can shoot there after we close all night or whatever it is, towards the end of the day kind of thing. So he goes, he prides himself, excuse me, rather on, you know, knowing how to steal location, knowing where to shoot. So like, please don't see you, you know, on the street, like shooting behind buildings, shooting in alleyways in that way, and really kind of trying to make it work. So yeah, a lot of that is, but when you're mentioning here with this one, like actually paying the money, if you can get a really good deal, and taking your time and really kind of crafting, you know, some of these scenes when you're able to kind of give it that cinematic touch. So I love that you picked up on that. Yeah. I want to move on.
Would you be like stealing shit if you shot a movie? If you got, you know, somebody gives shit. You,
I mean, all the,
I mean, oh yeah,
bullshit music videos I used to do, like that all those locations were stolen. Like, we didn't pay for shit.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. I've done it both ways. Obviously, yeah. I've worked on shit where we got fully permitted and stuff, but I've stolen way more shit in my life than I've permitted.
Oh yeah.
But
yeah.
I'm just like, if you had to do a full feature length now, would you be stealing shit, or would you be like trying
as much as possible? You know what I mean? Like, you hear what, yeah. And I want you guys to all go back and revisit our Visions of Sonya Green episode with Max, and he gets into the, you know, the nitty gritty of what it took, like with his little, not, I shouldn't say little, but like with the, in comparative with the budget, like $35K, and people still, you know, we're doing this on favors and get what we can out of this. It's like, it sounds like, and for this, I think it was like $60K he had in the bank to start with before he started putting money on credit cards. That sound like, you know, for the layman, like $60,000, and we're in our Inside Baseball Films on Films. This is a good point to get into. That sounds like a lot of money. It's absolutely not. Like, you will burn through that immediately.
Oh, yeah, that's nothing.
I mean? Yeah, so it's like trying to steal every location. If you're working at that budget level, and I think, you know, to kind of prove yourself, and a lot of, like we're saying, this film, you know, going under the lore of those, you know, directors that are just like, I have a vision, I kind of want to prove myself.
Yeah.
You gotta go with the run and gun gorilla. Like, let's just, like,
totally agree.
Like, can we, yeah.
There's so many fucking directors that the only thing that they have as a qualifier, or like something as some sort of like reason why they can direct a movie, is that they have successfully directed a movie. Not successfully in that it was good or right. had any meaningful length of success,
right.
But just successfully in that I shot enough footage
right.
that they could edit a movie out of it and release it.
Right.
And that's good enough to get you in the door some places, is you just have to have shot a movie. It doesn't have to have been good. It just has to be completed.
Right.
And so I think, yeah, absolutely. If you're trying to do this, then your first one's gonna be fucking stolen. Like, you're gonna beg, borrow, and steal everything that you fucking can, for sure. But I love the stories that you were telling up top, though. It's like, in that, the flip side of that coin, though, is if people came out for you, the second that you can pay them back, you do. And that's him getting the check on a Sunday shows exactly why he is who he is, and the why the community came out to support him is because it's like, we all had your back because we knew that you were gonna have ours as soon as you could.
Right.
And like that's how you make fucking movies. That's what makes movies beautiful.
Hell yeah. Talk about some other beauty in this movie. I'm going to move on to my second shot here, which is the Jerry curl scene. Like, this is the, like I mentioned, the dark the dark surrealism of Keenan Ivory Wayans. And I love this. I'm like, I love the look too of Robert Taylor, like when he first pours the down, like how he just dismissively like throws the activator on the ground, and like the little kink of hair that comes out, and all as it gets kinkier and tighter on his head. She's like, all of this is so, when I leave this movie, this is the image I leave with his Keenan banging on the ground, and just how surreal and fucking funny this is for me about a man needing his activator so much that he was willing to be tortured to give up for information. It's such a funny fucking idea. This is like what Living Color was built on.
Yeah.
It's kind of surreal.
This movie feels like it's a very, very good TV show. Yeah. Like, hey. But this sequence is so long, though, to the point where, like, I'm laughing at this joke in the moment, and then I'm like, God damn, I've been watching this movie within a movie for a while now, haven't I?
Yeah. The Sam Mace one is, and I kind of, like you mentioned, the Real Brothers one is a long one, too. The Black Actor one goes on for a bit, too, because he had the Mandingo part, and then Robert Taylor.
And then, transitions.
And then we do the school thing. Yeah, so it's a lot of, like, this movie builds in vignettes. And you know, part of that being, because they shot over a course of 12 days over 2 years. And, like I said, Robert had 60,000 up top. When they burned through that, you know, he was having to work and try to get other acting jobs, and you know, when they got a little bit more money, renting a camera, and so he said, you know, over the course of 2 years they had 12 days and 12 of the hardest days of his life, but they ended up putting together the film. So a lot of this you can tell,
that's like, crazy that it's only 12 days.
All the money he had, all they could afford for it. And then you know, so a lot of it feels like, you know, they go off and start spinning their wheels a little bit, and then vignettes, and you can, maybe that's over the course of the first 6 months, or maybe it's the 8 months at this period that they were able to put the, whatever it was, put together, and then building on the film in that way. So, like Sean mentioned up top, I'm definitely wrong with the experimental. Don't touch a frame of it. Like Samuel Golden and Sean New. Like, this is something special. You don't need like the digital story on this one. I'm going to move on to my last shot, and it's the shot of the circle of death, the halo of death. Clearly, he's borrowing from a lot of different films throughout this one. This is the Harold Lloyd. Harold Lloyd, for those in the know, is the like the Buster Keaton, Charlie, like the three-headed silent film monster back in the day. Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton. Harold Lloyd is the dude that was like hanging off the clock. He also has this shot where everyone's like pointing the gun at him in a circle. So like John Wick, excuse me. James Wick. John Wick did that for the posters on one of them where all the guns are like face. So that's a Harold
Oi, Lloyd. I'm Jimmy Wick.
Oi. That's the Tom Hardy version of it.
I'm John Wick's British cousin, Jimmy Wick. Isn't it?
Shit, so this is I love borrowing that with little halo of death and then adding the noose with it for what Robert Townsend did as a black filmmaker being crucified for some of his choices in here of him doing some cooning at the end of this. So it's,
I love the blonde reporter pulling out she's got the microphone in her right hand.
Yeah.
And then when everybody else pulls out her gun, she picks up her left hand and she has a full fucking like Mac 10 with a silencer on it. Like fucking
good rules. Oh yeah, so that's my last shot. I always love that. All right,
it's a like fucking Uzi.
Yeah. Great shit. All right, McGee, like I mentioned, I think combination of craft, I think the vignettes, you know, are really, really spent. The idea of the vignettes, maybe the experimental nature of this film, is really what I undervalued it when pitching it. I've made my mistakes. I'm learning now. Maybe that's the true value of this film here. So I want to give that the combo of craft.
Yeah, for sure. I think this is definitely something. I don't know that I'll like. It'll pop into my head at some point, and I'll throw it on again.
Bullshit.
I don't know.
McGee's not throwing this on again.
Well, I'm not gonna throw it on as like a, you know what, I really want to watch, but it is gonna be something that like. I'm gonna like a scene is gonna pop into my head for some audio clip in a future episode or something. Yeah, yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like I can see, yeah. I could see dropping this as a cutaway joke in a future episode and like going back and watching a couple scenes and whatever. Like, it's definitely something that is going to live in my head for a while.
Because I can't say it's like a film that I watch because it's been a while since I've seen it. But I had when the Criterion came out, I watched it again and watched with, you know, the special feature and everything, fell in love with it. But mainly, I think my interaction with the film was like, I would look up the Jerry Curl scene or I'd look up Real Brothers. So like,
yeah,
like, watch
exactly.
That. So like,
it lends itself to that movie for sure.
Yeah. I like that. I want to give a little love really quick to music to our ears. And this is composer Patrice Rushen, and Yudi Harpez, I believe. Just because I think the music is fantastic and they had a myriad of styles that they had to meet. So I like that they were able to kind of blend in, like, believable, maybe, like it felt texturally like it would, the music belonged in a certain different, like the Dirty Larry sequence, as opposed to the Sam A sequence, like the music you know, feels unique to those two different genres. So
that's one of those things. What's the Ludwig, whatever his fucking name is,
the new with Gordonson with Almost Up for the Oscar tonight? Or you mean, wait, with Amadeus? You're talking about Beethoven?
No, I was talking... No, you were Goranson. Yeah. However you say his name. No. But he like started on fucking Community. So that's...
Oh, really? I didn't know he started with Community. I thought he started with Ryan Coogler and with...
No, dude. He was Ludwig. Ludwig did... Well, I'm sure he did that too. That's like around the same time.
Oh, okay.
But he was doing the scores for Community, so when Community was doing weird genre stuff, he's getting to play in all of these different things. And then out of that, he starts to like branch out into other stuff, and then he's picking up real, real big shit.
Yeah.
But it was like he really got to flourish in that like satire zone, went on to go do stuff. So it's like movies and shows like this.
Deming here, like we were just talking about that. Like you're able to play in the sandbox a little bit. You mentioned your experience too of coming out, or you were shooting, black folks, was it in Florida? Or you got to learn skin tones and have the experience of like experimenting with shooting and lighting different people with different complexions a lot earlier in your career than people might have when they moved out to LA and found out that that could be a problem if you don't know how to light people that are darker than you, whatnot. So, for sure. It's interesting to get that experience early and then seeing how that translates later on in your career. And a lot of those folks, that's such a good note, dude. So I'm glad you stuck with it. I didn't think he was going to fuck with it, but you ended up fucking with it a little bit.
You underestimate me sometimes, but not always. Sometimes I disappoint you, so I get it. It's okay. You disappoint me too sometimes, but that's the...
Did I disappoint you for Galaxy Quest? What do you think? Just go and just do a little...
Oh, no, that was good. That was about what I expected. Yeah. I think you saw the vision. Like I said, it's not something that I'm like super near and dear with, but I've watched it enough. I'm not like one of those, like, it's a perfect movie. But
it's a lot of love.
Yeah, there was one, like, it was like Barbarella. I could tell you were just being nice to Natalie.
Speaking of which, continuing our being nice to Natalie track, let's talk about what's coming up next in our upcoming Zoom segment after this.
Coming this March to video stores everywhere.
All right, guys. Coming up next, if you've seen our show bills, you know what's coming up next. It's 1982's Tootsie. We're bringing on special guests again, Uncle Aunt Nat. Hope you guys are enjoying the Uncle Aunt's private stash outreach. I know you guys, this is a little off. Maybe we talk about this off mic, but you guys didn't want to post them up on the Patreon. I kind of miss posting them up on the Patreon. I'm like, it's just the little goodies that we got throughout the week. So I may be reposting up the March one. Was it the March one? No, this is the March one. No, the February one, excuse me. The sexploitation is what I didn't post up. Because I want to kind of show that off. Because I liked a lot of the little sexploitation things that we got. Got a fun one coming up for March and looking forward to next month, too. Stick with films inside baseball, films on films. She's bringing to us 1982's Tootsie. Film, me, you've seen this, right, Mickey? Memory serves? We both have
it's
seen
one of those
this,
ones. I've seen it, but like, sort of. Like, I definitely didn't
want
pay.
To play Guess the Log Line? I think you know kind of.
Oh, I know. I know the general plot of Tootsie. Okay. I got the poster in front of me here. It's got a decent tagline on it. I think sums up the plot pretty nicely.
Tell us about it.
We got. Have you already watched it? Do you know?
Oh, yeah. I've seen Tootsie.
Yeah. So this is. What year did we say?
82.
1982's Tootsie, starring Dustin Hoffman. Tagline from the poster: what do you get when you cross a hopelessly straight, starving actor with a dynamite red sequin dress? You get America's hottest new actress.
Tootsie.
Tootsie. Coming up next week. It's going to be a fun one. I'm excited for
it. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, always fun to have Nat on.
Hell yeah. Some of our best and most beloved episodes. Judging by the downloads. Yeah, let's keep them coming. Available on Sling, Prime, and all your VOD hangouts. So we're covering Dustin Hoffman and Tootsie next week, guys. Looking forward to that. All right, McGee.
Next week.
Shit about LA. All right. Keep fucking Southern California out your mouth.
Hey, I love fucking Southern California. I'm not. I'm being realistic.
Oh, you got
realistic.
A weird way of showing it. You got a weird way.
I'm talking shit in the way that I like talk shit about my brothers. Like it's like I love them to death. They're not perfect though.
I love that. All right, brother. Next week.
Next week.
Hey, if you made it to the end of our show, you're the real MVP, and we want to thank you. If you want to reach out to us, email us at makemewatchpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on all your socials at makemewatchpodcast. Links are in the show notes. If you rate and review, shout out to you. Thanks. I'm going to tell you a little something. Sean doesn't want you to know there's exclusive content on our Patreon page where you can go to support the show, but you didn't hear that from me. Anyway, artwork by Supplaybox, theme song by Soulspy. Coming soon, folks.